Today is Wednesday, May 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a UN delegation looks for ways to help Myanmar's Rohingya refugees get back home.
There could be an untold and unimaginable humanitarian tragedy unless something is done quickly.
European diplomats suspect Israeli leader Netanyahu choreographed his Iran nuclear statement with the U.S. What are expectations of North Korea's promise to give up its nuclear weapons? Also ahead, a pop star turns tragedy into triumph. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, America's European allies are drawing a sharply different collective conclusion from the U.S. about Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's dramatic presentation Monday of evidence he said demonstrates Iran lied about its nuclear program. European diplomats suspect the Israeli leader's presentation, during which he urged President Trump to scrap the nuclear accord signed in 2015 between Tehran and six foreign powers, was choreographed with the White House. Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Tuesday that Iran has not been an honest broker in the deal.
The deal never should have been made in the first place, and even the fact that they had been known to be bad actors to some degree, the degree to which they were not being honest was not fully known at the time the Iran deal was made, is our understanding.
Well, joining us now to understand the Israeli intelligence and complexity behind all of it is Robert Deitz, former special counsel of the Central Intelligence Agency and National Security Agency, and currently a professor at George Mason University's Schar School of Public Policy. What is your response to the initial statement by Mr. Netanyahu?
The Israelis have very good intelligence capabilities. It does not surprise me that they're able to uncover Iranian-sourced materials. They're very well connected throughout the Middle East. They have first-rate signals intelligence. The fact that he obtained all this information, I don't find particularly surprising. What is a little unclear to me is exactly the timing of all this. That is, a lot of the materials that I've read described in newspapers talk about stuff pre-agreement. And the fact they were working on a program, that's not exactly a newsflash. That was the basis upon which the negotiations took place. The question is, what happened afterward? And I thought what Netanyahu said, was a little crafty on that issue. That is, after the agreement, what have they done? Mm-hmm. And as you know, there have been certifications by various outside observers that said that they've been observing the agreement.
Right. So basically what you're saying is it really didn't offer any new information?
No, not again from what I've read. Now, you know, he did quite a dog and pony show. As you recall, when he announced all this, he had a bookshelf filled with documents that he claimed weighed half a ton. And then he had a huge case of disks that he claimed also had intel on them. So it had great presentation. The question is, was any of this new? Was any of this a surprise? And from the reactions I've seen in the press, nobody's said much of anything except, of course, our president.
So in regard to this whole situation, European diplomats, America's European allies, they're drawing a sharp difference in their conclusion about Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's dramatic presentation. Obviously, President Trump was very much in agreement, said this is proof that Iran is lying. But the Europeans are suspecting the Israeli leader could have potentially even done that at the urging of President Trump, or vice versa, some sort of choreographed situation.
That's certainly possible. Who knows? It is certainly true that the Netanyahu presentation confirmed the arguments that President Trump was making long before he was president. That is to say, also long before he had intelligence information. And so I, like others, am suspicious. That is what, again, this could be is simply it's showing that the materials that are being shown are old news.
Do you have an opinion or a view on whether the U.S. would be wise to scrap the deal and start over?
I think it'd be very unwise. If the question is, Has Iran turned from a theocracy into a Jeffersonian democracy, and therefore, they're deserving of wild applause? The answer is, of course not. But it appears that the agreement, again, from the standpoint of outside observers, has held. And therefore, why would one not want to maintain that? Now, remember, Netanyahu's position is quite different. He may well think that, as argued, that Iran has violated the nuclear agreement, but his real concerns have nothing to do with that. His real concerns are Iranian troops off his border and Iranian proxies like Hezbollah right off the Israeli border. And so I think from his standpoint, he would like us to sort of line up with him.
All right. That's Robert Deitz, former professor, or not former professor, professor at the Schar School of Public Policy at George Mason University. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. At least 16 people are dead after a church attack in Central African Republic. Iraq's first election after IS brings unconventional coalitions. Pakistani police charge U.S. security officer in a traffic incident. California sues over a plan to scrap car emission standards. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. South Korean President Moon Jae-in wants the United Nations to help monitor North Korea's closing of its nuclear test facility. Moon's spokesman said Tuesday the president expressed hope in a phone call with UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un pledged to close the test site by the end of May. The development is part of a wave of diplomacy that has included a summit between Moon and Kim and planned talks between Kim and President Donald Trump. North Korea last tested a nuclear device in September of last year, and its most recent ballistic missile test was at the end of November 2017. Joining us to talk about the upcoming summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un is Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute.
Well, look, it's hard to know with the North Koreans whether this will go well. The signs are as good as they've ever been. North Korea and South Korea have at least discussed a framework concept. They've discussed the idea of complete denuclearization. Today, they were dismantling the loudspeakers on either side of the demilitarized zone that have been broadcasting propaganda since the 1960s. So positive signs. But, you know, as Condi Rice said today, you know, there's three things she wants the new administration to think about. One, you can't trust the North Koreans. You have to be very careful. Number two, you got to take these things step by step. And number three, you know, we've been here before. So, you know, be cautious, but it doesn't mean don't take advantage of an opportunity. So I think that that's exactly right. I mean, I think that's the way the administration is approaching it.
What about the talk recently from President Trump about the location and how he'd like to see it on the demilitarized zone? Because if things worked out, it would be a big celebration.
President Trump is, after all, a showman. I mean, he's been that way since before The Apprentice. You know, part of his whole mystique and the way he's designed his apartment buildings and the way he's sort of run his selling the message, and it's how he got elected president. So not surprising he's looking for that. From what I understand, the sort of two locations are now down to Singapore and Mongolia, so we're not talking about the DMZ. But look, I mean, he's the president of the United States. He is looking to do a deal. If that means going to the DMZ, then, you know, maybe that's where they'll end up.
I mean, ultimately, it really doesn't matter where it is. It really matters about the substance, right?
That's exactly right. What matters is the substance, not the location. And for the United States, what that means is complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And now that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, although it's hard to understand what complete denuclearization doesn't mean other than no weapons. But there are a lot of steps between here and complete denuclearization. It involves no weapons programs. It involves dismantling existing weapons. It involves dismantling delivery vehicles. It means dismantling plutonium development capabilities, uranium enrichment facilities. And it means not having a secret program because, you know, we've seen this show before where everyone says, yep, we're in. We're going to start removing our stuff. We'll make things, you know, civilian nuclear. And then come find out there's been a secret program the whole time. And by the way, here's what.
All right. Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. Thanks for being with us. Well, a report this week in the New York Times lists what it says are questions the special counsel wants to ask President Trump that show the focus of investigators includes collusion and obstruction of justice. But there are questions about who may have written the questions and how they were leaked. Legal experts are casting doubt. Joining us now is Ron Hosko, a former assistant director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and currently the president of the Law Enforcement Defense Fund. What did you think of all of this?
I imagine this could have come from questions proffered by Mr. Mueller's team and assembled by Trump's team. But what strikes me is the lack of really anything new. You know, knowing Bob Mueller a bit, how I would expect him to go about his work, I certainly wouldn't regard these questions as exclusive. And we should assume that if there's ever a sit down between Mueller and or his team with the president and counsel, that there would be much follow-up, that the questions certainly wouldn't be limited to these or to, you know, even others, that any investigator worth their salt is going to commit themselves to follow-up, and the follow-up questions could be as extensive as a short list like this.
There are some legal experts that are saying that the questions published aren't how Mueller would word things, or really a prosecutor for that matter, asking a subject questions.
Well, you would want to drill into any responses. And, you know, a lot of these questions seem to lead to kind of or poke at president's state of mind. And it's very likely that Team Mueller already has plenty of substance and interview responses from others that answer what they believe to be the state of mind. Certainly Mueller's primary goal is not to set a trap and not to open the door for a bevy of lies. What he wants is the truth.
Let's talk about how this was leaked. It doesn't sound like something the special counsel would be wanting to leak.
No, I don't think so. And so I would be surprised if this is exclusive. Have to believe that others, particularly those who have shown a willingness to take a guilty plea, have filled in a lot of the gaps, and that there are perhaps more questions and plenty more that Mueller knows that we don't know. My premature judgment on the president's tweet, the implication was that it had leaked from Mueller's people, and quite clearly from the article, it suggests otherwise, that this perhaps was written down by Trump's people and somehow came out of their camp. So, again, credit to Bob Mueller and credit to his team that we're working in the dark. We still don't know what they know. Again, my assumption would be after looking at this list that there's nothing particularly new here. This is all ground that we've heard about. These connections have been very often publicly reported on. If this is accurate, Mueller's team hasn't revealed their best stuff.
The latest now coming from the Washington Post is that Special Counsel Mueller, in a meeting with President Trump's lawyers, raised the possibility of issuing a subpoena for Trump if he declines to talk to investigators in the Russia probe. What do you make of that? Is that how likely would that be that he would have to be subpoenaed, a president being subpoenaed? Could he refuse to talk and then ultimately get subpoenaed? What are all the implications here for this?
I could see a situation where the president's team, for fear that the president would perhaps mistakenly decide to sit down with Mueller's investigators or with Mueller himself, feel like it's a better strategy to maybe move slower, to try to run out the clock in some way to drag this on. And that would, I think, likely result in some court action where Mueller might try to subpoena the president, and then the battle would be joined as to whether the president has to follow that subpoena. Could he be compelled? I think we would have some legal battles playing out before we saw that ultimately happen. But I do think this about Bob Mueller. He is, and we have discussed this in the past, this is a serious-minded person who is mission-driven, mission-oriented. And if he believes that the ultimate goal to know the truth from the president's own mouth means an interview in some form or fashion, I don't think that Mueller would settle for written interrogatories that could be lawyered on the other side and really answered in a lawyerly way by the attorneys and not by a subject of the investigation or the president himself. There's some risk in accepting those sorts of answers. I think that Bob Mueller, if he thinks he must hear it from the president's mouth, I think he will work toward that end. And if that means a battle in federal court, issuing a subpoena, insisting upon a face-to-face interview, whether it's in a grand jury setting or an office setting, if he thinks thinks that's what's needed, I think he will drive toward it and not relent until either he gets his way or a federal court says, no, you can't do this.
All right. Ron Hosko, former assistant director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, currently the president of the Law Enforcement Defense Fund. Thanks for being with us. A U.N. Security Council delegation Tuesday visited Myanmar's Rakhine State, where hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims have fled military-led violence. Among the diplomats was Deputy Russian U.N. Ambassador Dmitry Polinsky.
Well, I'm overwhelmed by the information. That's really very, very touchy, especially this refugee situation. And, of course, the first priority is to do something to help them.
Well, nearly 700,000 Rohingya fled the troubled area and are now living in squalid camps in Bangladesh. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Vikram Nehru, non-resident senior fellow with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, about the council members' recommendations.
The most important recommendation was that the Rohingya refugees currently in Bangladesh, which number approximately now between 800,000 and 900,000, perhaps even a million, should be allowed to return voluntarily with safety, security, and dignity to their homes in Rakhine State. And I think that perhaps is the most important recommendation and the one I think we need to focus on because, investigating crimes against humanity and trying to get the evidence, frankly, takes the eye off the ball. The ball is that there are a million people who are leading absolutely miserable lives and who are in danger of substantial calamity once the monsoons strike in Bangladesh because they live in exposed mud hills in ramshackled refugee townships, which are absolutely huge. And so there could be an untold and unimaginable humanitarian tragedy unless something is done quickly.
Satellite imagery, though, shows many of these villages burned to the ground.
Yes, indeed. So that's why it's relatively easy to say that these refugees must be returned or repatriated with voluntarily and with safety and dignity. That's easy to say, but it's very hard to do. It's hard to do because there is no guarantee for the security of those Rohingya once they return. And there is no guarantee that they will have freedom of movement once they return. And there is no guarantee that they will have access to their fields of their livelihood once they return. And therefore, securing all of the conditions for a secure and safe return for the Rohingya refugees will require a lot of work between the international community and the Myanmar authorities. And that's why, in my view, casting blame and naming and shaming isn't the priority at this stage. The priority at this stage is alleviating the suffering of a large number of stateless people who have been through unimaginable atrocities. And to try and alleviate their suffering will require, first of all, substantial support to Bangladesh in providing food and health and education services to these people in these refugee townships, and to work with the Myanmar authorities in a low-key way, not in big splash visits, but in a low-key way to try and establish the security conditions and the economic conditions for the return of these refugees. That is a long-haul task. It's a task that will require quiet diplomacy and substantial effort at the grassroots. And while the support could be given by the international community, there has to be accountability on the part of the Myanmar government to respond positively to approaches by the international community. And that is the only way forward. So it's easy to say the return of the refugees. It's very hard to do.
A lot has been said about the fact that the Myanmar government, headed by Aung San Suu Kyi, has no real control of the Myanmar military. So how can the government work together collectively, be urged to do so, even in a quiet way, to allow these refugees to come back in a situation that's been likened to ethnic cleansing?
Well, that's precisely the challenge. I think the challenge is going to be to convince the Myanmar government that if they don't allow the refugees to return, they will be inviting trouble in the long term. Because 1 million refugees living in absolutely deplorable conditions on the other side of the border would surely be a magnet for radicalization. It's not to say that the Rohingya are violent people. They are peace-loving people, and they have been subject to abominable atrocities. But any desperate people who are kept in desperate conditions will turn to desperate measures to alleviate those conditions. And they should realize that it is in the best interest of Myanmar, of the Myanmar military and of the Myanmar civilian government, to allow these people to return so that they do not become a magnet for radicalization, and to give them the dignity that they require, access to political voice, to allow them freedom of movement, and to give them economic livelihood.
That's Reek from Nehru, senior fellow with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. This is International Edition.
This is Russ Davis. Join me as I take you to the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. for the induction of Joanne Brackeen, Diane Reeves, and Pat Metheny into the hallowed hall of NEA Jazz Masters. The 2018 NEA Jazz Masters on the next Jazz America.
Well, scientists have expressed shock at the speed at which resistance to powerful antibiotics is able to spread from humans or animals to humans. New research shows how antimicrobial resistance to a key medicine likely spread from a pig farm in China to affect human and animal species around the world in the space of just a few years. Here's Henry Ridgewell.
Colistin is a medicine of last resort, used to save people's lives when all other drugs have failed.
It was used a bit in the clinic, and then there were some worries about toxicity and side effects. And it was mostly used in agriculture, then in pigs and a bit in chicken. But recently, as we're running out of drugs, people actually have become more interested again in using it. And it's been used quite extensively recently over the last 5-10 years in the clinic.
But even this powerful antibiotic is losing its potency. Deadly pathogens like E. coli or Salmonella can mutate and develop resistance to drugs. The new study, led by Ballou at University College London, identifies the speed at which the mutant gene that gives resistance to colistin emerged in the mid-2000s.
There was a single emergence, only once. It happened once, and it jumped very, very likely from pigs, probably in China, and it spread extremely rapidly throughout the world. And it also spread in all sorts of different species and affect humans. So now we find it in many of the most important pathogens we face in hospitals. And it is absolutely everywhere now.
The resistance has even been found in pathogens in the seawater on Brazilian beaches. This study focused on just one resistant gene. Many pathogens are developing other forms of resistance. Britain's chief medical officer warned recently that antimicrobial resistance could lead to the end of modern medicine.
Think about common operations, cesarean sections, replacement hips. Those would become much more risky if we did not have effective antibiotics. Superbugs kill, and they're on the rise.
Scientists are working on boosting existing drugs like colistin to give them added power against resistant pathogens. Longer term, researchers say more investment is needed in developing new drugs, along with rethinking the way antibiotics are used in agriculture and in the clinic. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Well, sometimes good things can follow tragedy. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London talks about it with Sarah Williams.
We're going to premiere the brand new single off of Ariana Grande's upcoming fourth album. The song is called No Tears Left to Cry. Ariana Grande marked the one-year anniversary of a very tragic event in her career and in world history when on May 22nd, 2017, she was performing at the Manchester Arena in England. A suicide bomber detonated a bomb after her show was ending, causing 23 deaths and over 500 injuries. Ariana hosted a television benefit concert called One Love Manchester about a month later and raised over $23 million for the victims and their families. And she was also named an honorary citizen of Manchester. She's been here in D.C. Recently, I guess a couple of months ago, she performed at the anti-gun rally that took place in Washington, D.C. and around the United States, hosted by all of these high school kids, started by the Parkland, Florida, tragedy as well. So she's been involved with all of these different events. This song, the new song, was inspired by the Manchester bombing and the tragedy that took place there, and it's called No Tears Left to Cry. So we're going to listen to it right now.
Right now. I'm in a state of mind. I want to be Well, this whole experience must have been very tragic, very, you know, very poignant for her to remember, you know, for her and the families of those people that were killed and or, you know, injured in this.
Yes, and she's done her part as an honorary citizen of Manchester. She's kind of visited with a lot of the victims and their families, and she's, you know, she was embraced. Her album Dangerous Woman, the sales of the album increased. It was up near the top two or three albums at the time as well, because they loved Ariana, and she was kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time, where somebody wanted to send out their message during a pop concert, knowing that this was going to affect a lot of young people who attend pop concerts. So this was a devastating event for her and you know, as I say, for the whole community at large, her fans around the world, for everyone involved. Now, Ariana, her career has been great. I mean, you know, this is going to be the fourth album when it comes out. We don't know the name of it yet. This is the lead single from the new album. No Tears Left to Cry is the song. It debuted on the Billboard charts at number 3. It's the 9th song in her career to hit the top 10 on Billboard. It debuted at number 1 on iTunes. If the song is in fact the lead single from her studio album, she'll be the only artist ever to have debuted the first single from her first 4 albums in the top 10. The only artist ever to do that. She has 55 million Twitter followers, making her the 14th most followed person on Twitter. Her videos have been viewed a total of 9 billion times. And as far as awards and accolades go, she's got 3 American Music Awards, 3 Euro Music Awards from MTV. She's got 4 Grammy nominations, and she was Billboard's 2017 Female Artist of the Year. So she's definitely got a lot of accolades, including 2016. Time Magazine put her in their 100 Most Influential People issue as well.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. Yeah.
That does it for today's International Edition, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After nearly 50 years of military rule, Burma's democratic transition continues to face many challenges, including atrocities and other serious human rights abuses in Rakhine State committed against the Rohingya minority. In his remarks marking the release of the annual State Department Human Rights Report, then-Acting Secretary of State John Sullivan condemned the ethnic cleansing of Rohingya and all the atrocities committed against them. The U.S. is working with its partners to address the crisis and hold those responsible accountable. The Human Rights Report for Burma notes that in early August, some security forces deployed throughout northern Rakhine State committed enforced disappearances and arbitrary arrests and displaced villagers, the majority of whom were Rohingya. On August 25th, the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army claimed responsibility for coordinated attacks against 30 security outposts in northern Rakhine State, killing 12 security personnel. Security forces, as well as local vigilante groups acting independently or in concert with security forces, then committed widespread atrocities against Rohingya villagers, including extrajudicial killings, disappearances, rape, torture, arbitrary arrest, and burning of tens of thousands of homes and some religious structures and other buildings. This forced nearly 700,000 Rohingya to flee to neighboring Bangladesh as of April 18th, as well as an unknown number of ethnic minority groups to be displaced within Rakhine State. The Burma Human Rights Report documented other significant human rights abuses in 2017. Unlawful killings, politically motivated arrests, authorities' human rights violations against civilians in other ethnic minority areas, particularly in Kachin State and Shan State. Journalists have suffered intimidation and arrest. Freedom of religion, speech, and assembly continued to be restricted. Harsh conditions in prisons and labor camps persisted. Statelessness for some populations and severe restrictions on freedom of movement continued. The government still criminalized same-sex sexual activities, and trafficking in persons continued to be an issue. The protection of human rights is crucial to the success of any democracy. The United States wants Burma's democracy to succeed, and it is critical that the government continue reforms and demonstrate respect for human rights, including the rights of its Rohingya minority.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.